This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with the Secretary of State for the great state of Louisiana, the Honorable Robert Kyle Ardoin, Republican from Brule. He's been in office now for 3.5 years, twice elected to a position of importance and one that is relevant in this age when people are looking at elections closer and closer. And there have been some developments in the last few weeks because of Hurricane Ida. And the Secretary of State's been on the road looking over the scene, and elections have been postponed. And he's here to provide an update and is at your service at 877-217-5757. Mr. Secretary, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
Nice to hear Kyle Ardoin's voice. Tell us what's going on. Obviously, we're going to have elections in October and November. It'd be November and December rather than October and November. What precipitated that?
Well, of course, the effects of Hurricane Ida created the necessity to push back the elections. I recommended to the governor to move the elections from October 9th to November 13th. And from November 13th to December 11th, given the fact of the amount of devastation in southeast Louisiana, about 42% of total voters in our state were affected and impacted by this. And so we're looking at our assets. We're visiting with clerks and registrars and parish officials in all the affected area this week, each day. Today I'm in Orleans, Jefferson, St. Charles, St. James, and St. John. And, of course, we're looking at polling locations, issues with displaced voters, and all the issues surrounding the impact of Hurricane Ida.
So December 11th will be the final election, presumably, for the state for 2021. That's obviously 2 weeks before Christmas. These elections generally are low turnout ones, but in New Orleans in particular, there's some big items, including the mayor's election. Your thoughts about how turnout will be affected, which was already expected to be low? Are you concerned that this may even drive it lower?
Well, that was one of the reasons, one of the major reasons, Jim, that we asked the governor to delay the elections, because, you know, folks that were impacted, the first things that everybody's worried about is shelter and food and being able to recover. And so in order to give voters the opportunity to participate and get things settled in their lives as much as they possibly can, that's why we asked for that's one of the major reasons why we asked for the delay. And I think it'll assist us, because I think we were going to be looking at record low turnouts had we moved forward with the elections, just because so many people were impacted and worried about their own personal situations and that of their friends and neighbors and family.
All right. So the runoffs, if they are necessary, December 11th, and the primary again is November the
13th.
October
early voting will begin for the November 13th election. Will begin October 30th.
Now, last year, of course, we had heavy turnout. It was a presidential election year, and there were methods taken to make people safer in the COVID age. And unfortunately, we're still in unsafe territory when it comes to coronavirus. But these are lower turnout elections. Does that affect the way you approach them as far as what was done last year compared to what is planned for this year?
We will continue our efforts of sanitation. We will focus in on making sure that there are masks for all voters who want to use them. We encourage the use of masks. Obviously, we'll wipe down each machine during early voting and on election day after each use. We'll have hand sanitizer available, et cetera. So we'll take all the necessary sanitation precautions, but we're going to run our election as normal as possible.
All right. 877-217-5757 for Kyle Ardoin, the chief elections officer in the state of Louisiana, Secretary of State. Now, Tracy at the Capitol at talk@talklouisiana.org says, would it be a good idea to have voters provide proof of vaccination in order to vote? What do you think?
I think, you know, obviously we can't prevent anyone from voting that appears and is a qualified voter. So that we would not be asking for any of that proof whatsoever. But we certainly encourage folks that want to get vaccinated. That's the options that we have. We, in the previous elections, we didn't have the option of vaccination. So we're actually, you know, encourage folks. I've been vaccinated. All of my family's been vaccinated. So I certainly think it's an important thing for folks to do in order to protect themselves.
Yep, no doubt about it. You are one. I don't think you've had COVID, have you?
No, I've not. Grace of God, I've not caught it. But I've, you know, I've been careful, as careful as one can be. And especially my daughter is a type 1 diabetic, and so she has issues. And then was also pregnant with my grandson, and he's now 3 months old, and so we are protective of him as well.
At least three of the statewide elected officials have had COVID, Billy Nungesser, Jeff Landry, and John Schroeder. Now, Kyle is, by political standards, as we know, based on what's happening in Washington, he's a young man, 54, and the listeners, Hal in Monroe, says, you're the youngest statewide elected official. Actually, I think Jeff Landry is a little bit younger. I believe he's 50, but every statewide elected official in Louisiana is above the age of 50, which in the old days was an old man, but thank God it isn't anymore. Donna on Drusilla. Donna, you're on with Secretary Ardoin. Hi, Donna.
Hi. How does the change in the voting dates affect the mail-in voting? Thank you.
All right. How does it affect mail-in voting?
It does not affect it. So if you've requested an absentee ballot, you've already received it. If you've already voted it and sent back, it's an appropriate ballot to be presented to be properly counted. So there's no need to request another. And the new deadlines will be out. But, of course, the deadline to return an absentee ballot is 4:30 p.m. the day before the election. So that would be 4:30 p.m. December the 10th. November the 12th.
Craig in Natchitoches. Craig, you're on Talk Louisiana with Secretary Kyle Ardoin. Hi, Craig.
Okay, good morning, Jim. Good morning, Secretary Ardoin. Secretary Ardoin, I have a question. And Jim, I had called in a couple of weeks ago when Mark Ballard was on about the same subject. In the 2008 4th Congressional District race, which I live in, it was either Ike or Gustav. I don't remember which hurricane. The whole thing was scheduled, and we had a closed primary that year. What I want to make sure, I always worry about somebody getting cost a seat, and Paul Carmus clearly got cost that seat because the final showdown between him and John Fleming should have been on the presidential election day when Obama was elected the first time, when Paul Carmus got more votes than the two Republicans on their side combined, but he lost in a final showdown in the second week in December. That showdown should have been on the presidential election day and essentially cost him the seat.
All right. Sometimes those things happen, but Secretary Ardoin, I'm sure you made this decision just based on what was necessary, and this time we don't have any congressional races on the ballot, but obviously things could be affected, races could be affected by the dates they're held. Your thoughts, Secretary?
Well, we took into consideration the effect on voters and obviously the assets necessary to pull off a fair and accurate election and a secure one. And so we felt like this was the best option to enact. I can't take in the political consequences. I have to make sure that we're doing the best we can for a fair and accurate election. This is a statewide election required by the legislature, and so we're unable to bifurcate this election because then we wouldn't be able to audit this election. Back in 2008, we didn't have an audit procedure post-election, and now we do. And so we need to make sure we follow all of our processes and procedures and make sure all the parishes are working at the same time. And I wouldn't be able to hold election results in some parishes and hold elections in others. So it's a complicated process, but to have the most fair and accurate and safe election possible, this was the best option for us.
Another listener, Tom on Bluebonnet, asks about closed primaries versus open primaries. Craig, a moment ago, mentioned that in 2008 in that congressional cycle, we had closed primaries. Do you have a preference? Do you like things the way they are, or would it be better if we had a change? Your thoughts?
Well, obviously, that's a decision for the legislature to make. There was legislation proposed in the last session to look at that, and it didn't make it through the process. I think we have a good system as it works now, but if the will of the people and the will of the legislature is to change that, then we'll have to make adjustments to the process. But for now, I think we're doing really well. We're a leader in the nation on our elections integrity, and want to continue that.
Kyle Ardoin with us for a few more moments. He is traveling the state, informing the populace, the registered voters, that November 13th will be the date of the primary because of the wrath of Ida, and December 11th is the date for any runoffs that are necessitated by two candidates not getting 50%. We'll talk more after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. A few more minutes to talk with Kyle Ardoin, Secretary of State, Paul Annopoulosis. Paul, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning to you, Paul. You're on with Secretary Ardoin.
Yes, good morning, Paul. Jim. Good morning, Secretary. Just two short questions. The latest census, when will that affect be transmitted to elections, the lines and everything like that? I know it's going to take some time. And second, how can, and I love it, how can we can get results quicker through the Secretary of State's website than local websites? And that's always amazed me, and you do a great job. Thank you. Bye.
All right.
Well, thank you very much. The transmission is an issue in some areas because, as some folks don't realize, we do real-time check-in for early voting, and so that no one can go and vote in another spot in their parish. So we have to make sure our transmission is up and running, which is one of the issues I'm dealing with now in some of the hardest impacted areas. And so we have to make sure our communications is complete and secure. The other thing that I'm forgetting the second part. Jim, do you recall the second part?
I think you covered it with your answer. Lou on Highland. Thank you, Kyle. Lou on Highland, you're on with Secretary Ardoin.
Hi. I recently started mail-in voting, and I realized that these ballots are so complicated that the Russians could never falsify our election because you have to have districts and exits, et cetera, et cetera. What's your thought on that?
No, I agree. I appreciate you bringing that up because our election system is very secure. We use a special kind of paper that can't be replicated. If it is replicated, it'll be caught in the process. Also, of course, the absentee ballot request process is a rigorous process to make sure that folks, the qualified folks, are the ones that are getting the ballots. And the registrars and the parish board of election supervisors, which is a bipartisan group of the clerk, the registrar, a Republican member, a Democratic member, and a governor's appointee. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that make sure that those ballots are appropriate, they're safe, and they're accurate, and that they are secure and that counted.
What about the changes that the legislature approved in the last session? How substantial are they?
Well, it depends. The Voting System Commission is the one that's going to really do the vetting of the various election systems that we're being looking at obtaining. And so when that commission finishes its work, then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of trying to bring in a new voting system. But I can assure you that there will be a secure paper ballot process the way the legislation is written that we'll be implementing. We just have to figure out the best way to implement it and what type of equipment that we'll have so that we can make sure that we're getting accurate election results on election night.
Is it fair to say that you do not share the same kind of alarm that others do regarding problems with voting machines? Based on conversations in the past, I think I believe that you are confident that the machines we've used are accurate and that there has been no fraud, certainly not in Louisiana, but yet people right now are wary of machines. Your thoughts?
I certainly understand where folks are coming from in terms of being wary of voting machines, but obviously I am confident of our system in Louisiana. We have enough checks and balances in the process. And Jim, as we've discussed on many times, being on your radio program, and I appreciate always the opportunity to do so, is that I've always said that paper must be part of the process in order to accurately make sure that folks are getting, believe that their vote is secure and accurately counted. And so, I've been trying to move to that type of a system, continuing the machine base, the electronic base, in order to have unofficial results on election night. And if we move to paper, which I think we probably will, we'll still have to have electronic component because we'll have to have scanners to make sure that that we have unofficial results on election night like all Louisianans want and are accustomed to. But we have to have checks and balances in the process, and that's what we're trying to get to.
Will this new system, though, potentially delay the results and us knowing who wins and loses in close elections?
I mean, it depends on the system that we obtain. And my goal is to have a system that will provide us unofficial results on election night so that voters have confidence in, one, that their vote was accurately counted the way they wanted it to, anticipated to. And then also to make sure that we're not still counting votes after election day. And I think that's where we differ from other states, is that we don't allow votes to be counted beyond election day.
Kyle Ardoin, thank you for joining us, and a reminder to our listeners, and of course we'll be talking about this in the next 7 weeks. November 13th is primary date now because of a pushback due to Hurricane Ida. And runoffs are slated for December the 11th. The listener does ask about the amendments. Are they all on the November 13th ballot, Mr. Secretary?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Yes, they are. All four of them will be on that ballot.
And, of course, in that realm, there are no runoffs. So they will be determined on November 13th. Thank you, Kyle Ardoin. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you.
Appreciate you.
Bye-bye.
Philip Manuel's with us, the great singer from the great city of New Orleans, a man about town, and that town has been changed dramatically over the last year and a half, and Philip's been with us before talking about it, but we thought we'd be past this. It was March 16th of 2020 that Governor Edwards imposed his stay-at-home order, and here we are 18 months and 5 days later, and things are still uncertain. Good morning to you, Philip.
Hey, Jim. How are you, my friend?
Fine. How are things in your city?
Well, things are, they're okay. I don't know. I shouldn't say okay. The trash pickup thing has gotten to be a really bad subject. We don't seem to be able, there's been some pickup, but it's still way, way behind. That's a sore spot for a lot of people. I was reading in the paper this morning, one guy threatened to shoot the mayor if he didn't get his trash picked up. And, of course, they arrested him immediately.
Yeah, well, you know, the guy was probably kidding, but you can't kid around with stuff like that.
No, you can't. The trash pickup is a thing. And I have an issue with the crime. I mean, the crime issue is just, you know, we're still having an issue with that, with break-ins, with carjackings, things like that. And that really concerns me.
Philip Manuel, one of the best singers in the world, who has been sidelined for much of the last year and a half. Do you sing in the bathroom now? What do you do?
Because I sing, I kind of sing on and off all the time. I'm always humming or always, you know, working on something in my head. But it's been quite different not being able to perform live. A lot of gigs that I had were canceled, including the Jazz Fest. I was supposed to perform on the same day with the Rolling Stones this year. But, you know, of course, that's been canceled.
Mm-hmm. Some listeners are asking about particular venues. You're a staple at Snug Harbor. How's that place doing?
You know, I haven't checked on Snug Harbor. They were open and doing they were doing sets there. They had changed the venue in the sense that they put up a screen in front of the stage, and the audience had to sit so far back, you know, a certain distance back from them. I think they're still open and doing shows.
Well, Philip Manuel is a person who dominates any stage, and many of us remember him at Geno's, where he presided for many years and still on occasion. And, of course, the Hot Nights and Cool Jazz, the summertime venue at LSU. That one's kind of gone by the wayside, too.
Yeah, I miss those a lot. I really miss that one. You know, that was one of my favorites.
877-217-5757. We're going to take a short break for the news, and we'll return with the remarkable Philip Manuel and get his take on things in New Orleans and what this will do long-term to people like him. Fortunately for Philip, he has other things to do in his life, but for some people, this is it, and it's affected them dramatically. We'll talk about it. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number, 877-217-5757. The incomparable Philip Manuel's with us for a bit longer. The voice of jazz vocalist Philip Manuel is described as smooth, soothing, sophisticated, and soulful. This from Sharon Whitmer. It is all that and more. The elegant style of Philip Manuel fits in well with the venues where listeners tend to find him, classy hotels, clubs in his native New Orleans and around the world, as well as events such as the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival and the Satchmo Festival, gigging with jazz greats like Terrence Blanchard and Bill Summers. Philip Manuel's been around the world, but he calls New Orleans home. He grew up with some famous people, and in your day, Philip, some of the great vocalists and musicians of your generation, they were right down the street from you, weren't they?
Yeah, I grew up on the same block, the same two blocks with the Neville family. So I spent a lot of time with the family. And as a matter of fact, Aaron Neville and I would marry sisters initially in our lives. My first wife was his wife's first wife's sister. Of course, his first wife passed on and I've since remarried. But yeah, we were very close. I spent a lot of time with the Neville family. And there were a lot of musicians in that neighborhood, in addition to the Neville family.
Well, you are younger than Aaron Neville, but
I am.
Aaron has that distinctive style, and obviously, when you sing as he does, it's kind of like a baseball pitcher throwing a screwball. You're doing things with your vocal cords that others don't do, and you have to protect that voice. What do you do to protect your voice?
Well, the best thing you can do, Jim, is rest and drink water. I mean, it's kind of that simple. And stay away from, which I have a weakness for ice cream, but, you know, you kind of stay away from things that cause mucus, like milk and ice cream and things like dairy, you know, other dairy products. But, you know, rest and water are good for the vocal cords. The larynx needs to stay moist. The vocal cords need to stay moist in order to sing. So that's pretty much it.
What about smoking?
Smoking is not good. No, I can't imagine that's good for your voice. I'm not a smoker, so, you know, I've never had that habit.
Well, short term, it actually does give some resonance, but long term, it'll not only take that away, but it'll kill you too. But think of Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra. They both smoked heavily. And Frank.
I didn't know Frank did, but I knew Nat King Cole smoked really, really heavy. And that eventually is what took him out. I mean, he developed lung cancer, I believe, and he died at 45.
And he is somebody who you have admired, and some even say you sound a bit like him. I think that's relevant. Philip sounds like a lot of people, depending on what he sings, though. He has one of the most versatile vocal qualities of anybody on the planet. But Nat King Cole is a person of the singers. I would imagine you admire him. He would be like one, two, or three, wouldn't he?
He's pretty near the top. I have a few favorites. You'd probably be surprised who they are. I'm of course a Donny Hathaway disciple. I am an Ella Fitzgerald disciple. I loved Judy Garland, and I loved Andy Williams. To me, Andy Williams had one of the best voices I've ever heard. His technique was impeccable, and I listened to him quite a bit growing up on TV, on his television show. And of course, my grandmother, when I was a young boy, gave me a 12 record set or 6 record set of Nat King Cole's music, and of course I was immersed in it after that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he's in that top 5 for sure.
Now Andy Williams, he was a tenor. Now you, it's hard to classify you, isn't it?
I'm a baritone. I'm a true baritone. I used to have a good falsetto that I could use. I don't have much of a falsetto anymore, but my natural voice, I can still get into the second tenor range, but I'm a true baritone.
Well, what's this going to do, this situation where people like you are on the sidelines? Philip has a thriving real estate practice. He's also a public relations specialist. He has other ways to earn a living, but some of these people, I imagine, are really hurting.
Yeah, a lot of them are, and they're finding, you know, new ways to make a living. Some have gone to teaching. I have other musician friends who play in the church, and that has become, you know, their sole source of income. It's been tough, you know, and sometimes you see musicians, they'll do a Zoom thing or they'll do a virtual concert online, and they'll collect tips through Venmo or PayPal or some other source. You know, so yeah, musicians they're struggling down here, but I think we'll make it.
Well, we're going to hear Philip Manuel before we part, but Bill Bryan notes that Philip, it was 47 years ago today that a momentous event occurred in the music world. The song by Carl Douglas, "Kung Fu Fighting," hit number one. Alondra, do you have "Kung Fu Fighting"? Let's go for it.
I remember that song.
1974, number one with a bullet.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But they fought with expert time.
All right, that was number one for 3 weeks in a row in the year of 1974, in the month that Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon. Mike Schmidt led the major leagues with homers that year, finishing in September with 36, a rather pedestrian number today, but times were different in 1974. But that song, I still smile when I hear it, Philip Manuel.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Kung Fu Fighting.
Wonder if Frank Sinatra ever covered Kung Fu Fighting.
I doubt it.
But I bet he could have.
I really do doubt it. I'd be curious to hear how he would sound singing that.
I would.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Yeah, I could hear it.
yeah. He'd be snapping his fingers while he was doing it, too. Yeah. And Philip Manuel, he is a baritone, but his vocal style is such that people say he sounds like Bill Withers. People say he sounds like Nat King Cole. People say he sounds like Al Green on occasion. Here is the great Philip Manuel.
Bye.
All right. Philip Manuel not only has the voice.
Jim.
Yes, sir.
Where did you get that?
Alondra Villarreal pulled that out of her hat. But
wow.
It's
I was a tenor when I recorded that.
It's a great, great piece of music. And
yeah, that's from a movie soundtrack.
It is.
Called Cane River. Well, yeah, it was done in the movie was shot up in Cane River, Louisiana in the 80s, and I did the entire soundtrack to that movie. I recorded it, arranged it, sang it, but the music is the music of a very great songwriter who's passed on named Leroy Glover. I just took his songs and kind of made them fit the movie, I hoped. Mm-hmm.
Well, when you take the stage, you've got the voice, but you also have stage presence. You're a good-looking guy, and who does the wardrobe?
I do my own wardrobe. I don't have a wardrobe or a stylist. My son is a fashion designer. I should get him to help me with my wardrobe, but he's in Los Angeles.
You've got some impressive kids.
Yeah, I love them to death. My youngest son was up. He was the director of photography on a movie that was up for an Oscar this year, a documentary called Time. It was directed by a young woman named, what was Garrett's last name? I can't remember Garrett's last name. But he was the director of photography on the movie, and he is doing very well. And I have a son in Los Angeles who has a fashion line, and he sells a lot of stuff online.
Well, we look forward to your return to the stage and certainly to Baton Rouge. And I'm sure Philip Manuel in the next year will be back where he belongs in New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and parts unknown, doing his thing like few others have. Thank you, Philip.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for having me, man.
Always a pleasure. And we turn the page and go to Rudy Macklin. Second leading scorer in LSU basketball history. The number one scorer, by the way, is a fellow named Pete Maravich, who's the leading scorer in the history of college basketball. And Rudy is the leading rebounder in LSU basketball history. Not Shaquille O'Neal, not Bob Pettit. It's Rudy Macklin, the pride of Louisville, Kentucky. And we're about to go to a break, but Rudy spoke a week ago Friday on behalf of his former coach, Dale Brown. And I hear it'll be at the Kentucky game in Baton Rouge in the next season. The Dale Brown Court will become a reality. It took 25 years. We'll talk about that with Rudy Macklin. Dale Brown was a person who rattled cages. As John Lewis said, he made good trouble. And we'll discuss it when we return after this pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we're joined by Duran Rudy Macklin, the pride of Louisville, Kentucky. We'll get to Muhammad Ali and the documentary on LPB, but I did mention that a week ago Friday, the LSU board in its wisdom voted 12-3 to name the court at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center the Dale Brown Court, and this is a thing that's been done in many places across the country, and Dale Brown is without question the greatest coach in LSU basketball history. Some would say a long overdue acknowledgement of his accomplishments. His greatest team was in 1981, and Rudy Macklin was the star player, first team All-American on that team that went 31-5, won 26 games in a row, and went 17-1 in the Southeastern Conference. Dale Brown won four SEC regular season titles and the 1980 postseason SEC title, and two of the four titles in the conference were with Rudy Macklin, and the tournament win in 1980, he was on that team as well. 877-217-5757. Good morning to you, Rudy Macklin.
Hey, can you hear me, Jim, okay?
I can. And Rudy, you were recruited in Louisville, Kentucky. You could have gone to Kentucky. You could have gone to Louisville. You've told the story. You decided to come to LSU. And one of the reasons was that Dale Brown found a way to keep you away from Muhammad Ali, who was trying to get you to go to Louisville.
Yes, it was Coach Brown and Dale Brown and Art Tolis came to my high school. And I was going to announce then that the school I was going to attend, and I pretty much narrowed it down to Louisville and LSU, and there were some other schools, big name schools that came late, like UCLA and Maryland and all of them. But I was kind of leaning toward LSU at the time. And Coach Denny Crum, University of Louisville, kind of sensed something was going on. And he called and said, don't do anything until I get there. Take you to go talk to Muhammad Ali. And so I said, okay. And so I went back to my principal's office, and Coach Brown sensed something was going on. And he said, why don't you take me to that famous park where you learned how to play, called Shawnee Park? I said, oh, okay, I'll take you there. And so as we were coming out of the parking lot, we could see Denny Crum's car about to pull in. I said, well, Coach, let me go tell Denny Crum I'll be right back. He said, no, he'll be here when you get back. Just take me to the park, and we'll come right back. And we wound up staying 2 hours. And, of course, Denny Crum had left when we got back. And we talked about, you know, putting the team together. He said that he had recruited some guys to be around me, and he needed somebody that could make an impact right away. And so he said, if those other big schools that are recruiting you, basketball powers that are recruiting you, they'll do well whether you go there or not. But he said, if you come to LSU, you can always say you built something. And he was the only coach to ever say that. Out of all the coaches that recruited me, he's the only one that said, you can say, you always say you built something. And that really stood out in my mind and my heart. And so my dream became his dream. His dream became my dream. And so we came together, accomplished things, good things together.
No doubt. It did come to fruition. But Dale Brown was a person who rattled cages. And when he became coach and 1972, there was only one black player in the history of the school, and that was Collis Temple, who had been recruited not by Press Maravich, but by John McKithen, the governor of the state. And then within 5 years, there was an all-African-American starting five, Rudy Macklin, Dwayne Scales, Lionel Green, Kenny Higgs, and Ethan Martin. And some people, of course, didn't like that. And Dale Brown was a progressive, and he did what he thought was necessary to advance his program and to advance society. And at the end, his legacy was tainted by allegations from Lester Earle, which Lester Earle has now recanted and said he was lying when he was talking to the NCAA. So 25 years have passed. There is a bust, for example, at the Assembly Center in honor of Sue Gunner, who coached LSU's women's basketball team for 22 years, never won an SEC regular season title, but was a very good coach and had longevity. And produced some great players like Simone Augustus and Sylvia Fowles. But nobody has the legion of players that Dale Brown has who were accomplished on the court. But of the 160 of them, 112 have degrees, including Rudy, and 22 own businesses. There are 7 PhDs, 4 medical doctors, 3 engineers. It's been an accomplished group, and very few of them have been on the pages of newspapers charged with crimes. So, Rudy, was he more than a coach?
Well, he definitely was more than a coach. I was 18 at the time when I came and didn't know what the climate would really be like when I got here. Coach Brown had to change the culture at LSU because in two ways. The first way was everything was football. Football was the dominant sport there, and whenever there was a media day or any type of news about the upcoming football season, newspapers and magazines and sports outlets all across the country would come. But when we had media day, it was only the Morning Advocate and the Daily Reveille, the school newspaper. And there were no signs in the Assembly Center at the time it was called of a successful basketball team. There were no banners, no posters, no nothing. Even in his office, there were no banners or anything because he had been there 5 years before I arrived. And all the other big-time basketball powers that recruited me that I visited, the coaches had big trophies and banners and championships, conference championships, some of them national championships. And here I came to a school that didn't have these things, and they were last in the SEC. The coach was on the hot seat. And so he really had to change the culture of the school to get people to become interested in basketball, and it didn't come overnight. And so when he put 5 black players on the floor at the time of my sophomore year, then we begin to see as a team what he was going through. And we could tell it was taking a toll on him a little bit because he would take the backlash. He didn't take the approach of trying to thread the needle to please this person or this organization or that organization. He pretty much did not want to do the political two-step. He said, I'm going to do this my way by putting the best players on the floor that can give us the best chance at winning. He said, but it's all about winning. And so that's what he did, and we followed along with him and backed him up in every way we could by doing our best on the floor and in the classroom. And also, he had taken a lot of flack behind all of this. And so we stood behind him. And during that time also, Jim, the girls' basketball team was pretty doggone good at the time. Jinx Coleman, before Sue Gunner came, was very successful.
Yeah, they went to the championship game, championship game.
They had a lady named Joyce Walker and Jackie White. They had Jonette Butte, the first black African-American basketball player to play there. And two Australia girls were there. So they were very successful before Sue Gunner came.
And Australian girls, Julie Ross and Marie Benny Jackson, were brought here by Dale Brown, who paid their way to college.
Dale Brown opened the door not only for men's basketball, but he paved the way for women's basketball, too. James Coleman at the time and also Sue Gunner benefited from Dale Brown's hard work. He took the mix to get everybody on the same page and get everybody interested in basketball, period. So it was him that had that vision for not only boys, men's basketball, but also for the ladies to get them going, too. And so he did a tremendous job selling it to the public, put the best teams on the floor, and change the style. Because when Pete Maravich played, it was all about Pete Maravich. But Pete Maravich, as great as he was, he didn't win. But Dale Brown said, I'm going to put a team out there on the floor where we can win. That way everybody can be a part of it throughout the state and the country. LSU is going to be a winning program and not just based on one person.
All right. Well, I did want to mention to Rudy, Muhammad Ali, who is one of the most famous people in the history of the world, but grew up and lived in Louisville, Rudy's hometown, is the subject of a four-part documentary on PBS, Two of Ron, Two to Go, tonight, tomorrow night. Ken Burns, who did his first documentary about Huey Long, is a person who has put this together in a remarkable way. New York Times, it says, one day in the mid-90s, Ken Burns had a cold in Los Angeles to raise money for his next documentary. He ducked into a coffee shop for some hot tea, and after paying, one of the 20th century's most ardent historians turned from the counter and locked eyes with perhaps its most towering icon, Muhammad Ali. He was sitting in a booth nearby. The two men stared at each other silently for longer than most strangers would, celebrities or not. There was almost no movement on both of us except that kind of opening, that love that happens when you just feel unashamed and unembarrassed by the persistent gaze, Burns said. The wordless conversation. I have the script in my head. I heard his voice in my mind, but it was just without going over and shaking hands, not asking for an autograph or anything like that. Rudy, you knew him. I never met the man, but he had a big impact on my life, Muhammad Ali. Even today, 43 years after he won his last fight, he remains a towering figure both in athletics and for the culture at large.
He grew up in the west end of Louisville, where I grew up. He went to our rival high school, Central High. I attended Shawnee High, and that was a rival high school. It was three of us. It was three schools, Central, Shawnee, and Mayo High, the three inner-city schools, the basketball powers. And so he went to Central High.
Unfortunately, we got to leave it there, but we'll pick it up soon with Rudy Macklin. Always a pleasure. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for Talk Louisiana. Thank you for listening. Back tomorrow. Stay safe and stay tuned.